coming up on Philosophy Talk.
We're alike, you and I. Full of passion for what matters. So we can fight our way to a better world together.
Some philosophers think morality boils down to making the world better for everyone.
But who counts in everyone? Babies? Animals? Future people?
What does that say?
What man is a man who does not make the world better?
How can we even tell what makes the world better for someone else?
The only thing I ever wanted was a better world for the both of you.
Do you have a moral plan?
Doing good and living in accordance with your values does make people feel better and enjoy their life more.
Our guest is acclaimed moral philosopher Peter Singer, author of Ethics in the Real World.
I think that philosophy has made a real difference in that area.
I can change the world.
Making a Better World.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program, so that we can continue to question everything.
Except your intelligence. This year, it's been everything from cancel culture to contradictions, from wise women to weird ones.
So head on over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click Support Us at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosopher in your life, with a subscription to our library of nearly 600 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
Can philosophy help us become better people?
What can ethics tell us about ending poverty and suffering?
Are thought experiments ever relevant to real life?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about making a better world.
Ray, I'm telling you, making a better world would be a wonderful thing. And you know what? I think we need philosophers to help us do that.
Ah, come on, Josh. What are you talking about? Some of the worst people I know are philosophers. They're the last people we should be taking moral advice from.
What do you mean? I think you must be hanging out with the wrong philosophers. There are tons of thinkers out there who've not just had good ideas, but used them to change the world for the better. I mean, think about Du Bois, who played such a crucial role in the civil rights movement. Or Hannah Arendt, who helped organize reparations for Jews after World War II.
Yeah, Josh, not all philosophers are bad, but what I'm saying is that philosophers aren't any better than other people. I mean, there have been some terrible ones, too. Like John Stuart Mill, he talked a good game about freedom, but he was just in bed with the East India Company. Why should we listen to him?
Well, maybe because it's do as I say, not do as I do. I feel like we can reject Mill's career while still learning something important from his ideas. And if we want to make the world a better place, it's going to help us if we listen to interesting folks like him.
Okay, but there are also tons of philosophers whose ideas are bad, not just their actions. Like Immanuel Kant, he said that women were not fully rational beings. And David Hume said that black people are naturally inferior to white people. These are not ideas we should be living by.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, those are obviously terrible beliefs. But the point of studying moral philosophy isn't just to pick up a bunch of ideas, even in the cases where the ideas are good. It's also to sharpen our skills of moral reasoning. And if we want that better world we're talking about, we're going to need to think critically, think carefully, think insightfully about all the problems we face.
Okay, but if philosophy is such a great tool for thinking insightfully about moral questions, how come it keeps producing bad answers? Kant and Hume were using philosophical reasoning when they came up with their sexist and racist ideas.
I don't know. I think maybe they were failing to use their reason. That was just prejudice talking. And either way, what's the alternative, Ray? I mean, if you want people to do as much good as possible, and you don't want them to be guided by philosophical thinking about ethics, what else is there?
I don't know, maybe we could start by actually listening to the people who are most affected by our choices? Moral philosophers just spend so much time on these far-fetched thought experiments with trolleys and violinists. They totally miss out on everything that's ethically meaningful about the real world.
Well, that sounds good, but when you say listen to the people affected, how are you going to do that? That could be millions of people.
Okay, yeah, great question, but a lot of the time, moral philosophers don't even consider it. Like in the trolley problem where you have one person tied to one track who's going to die if you pull the lever, and five people tied to this other track, we're going to die if you do nothing.
I don't get the problem, Ray. I mean, it seems like that thought experiment is all about how people are affected by a decision you're making. What's it getting wrong?
Well, the whole setup assumes you know exactly who's affected and what the consequences are. In real life, for all you know, the train driver can just throw on the brakes, or the whole thing is a stunt for a movie, or there are even more potential victims down the track that you can't even see. These details are really important, and philosophy doesn't tell you how to think any of them through.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, we do need to do actual research to figure out the consequences of our actions for all parties concerned. But still, once we've done that research, we've got to weigh up everybody's needs and everybody's concerns. So we're still going to need moral philosophy.
I'm still not convinced, but maybe our guest will convince me. It's the renowned ethicist Peter Singer, author of Ethics in the Real World.
Thinking of ethics in the real world, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out how to think about athletes who break the rules. She files this report.
Luis Suarez is still known as the devil to soccer fans in Ghana because of his shenanigans during the World Cup semifinals in 2010.
Wherever Luis Suarez goes, something seems to happen. It was no different at the 2010 FIFA World Cup South Africa.
Unlike other Suarez controversies, this one did not involve biting other players. Suarez was playing for Uruguay, and Ghana was aiming to become the first ever African team to make the Final Four.
Here we go. Boateng's there. Keeper's lost it. Appy is there. Blocked on the line. Blocked on the line again.
With only seconds of extra time left, Ghana took a shot on a goal that should have ended the game. But then Suarez used both of his hands to stop the ball from landing in the net. For the record, Suarez is not a goalie.
What drama! It's Suarez on the line, the striker. Look at that as he beats it away, volleyball style. Suarez is off.
Ghana went on to lose 4-2, eliminated on a penalty shootout. Suarez was given a red card, but was still proud of himself. He declared, "Mine is the real hand of God," and has refused to apologize since.
I don't say the apologize about that, because I take the handball, the ball. But the Ghana player missed a penalty, not me. It's not my responsibility that they shoot the penalty.
It's like, really? That doesn't sit with me. And I think it didn't sit with a lot of soccer fans.
That's Stephen Moser, a recently retired professor of sports studies at Ithaca College in New York. He's been teaching about ethics and sports for decades. Antics like these frustrate him, but unscrupulous athletes don't surprise him.
The offense was so egregious that even the people who play all these games, like tugging jerseys and faking being fouled and flopping and, you know, writhing on the ground, even they knew that that was diminishing the game experience for everybody.
Moser has been cynical about ethics in sports for a long time. This goes back to when he was 13 years old playing first base in a youth baseball game. He missed the runner with the ball and the umpire called the runner out anyway.
Until I interjected, but I missed him. And the umpire spun around at me and said, "One more word out of you and I'm throwing you out of the game." I said, "But I missed him." And he threw me out of the game. It's the only time I've ever been thrown out of the game.
This was at a Catholic youth baseball organization.
And the coach was the parish priest. And he shook his head and he says, "Oh, that's life, Moser. This is sports."
Moser had been a good Irish Catholic kid who viewed the rules of the game like the commandments. Now he says society normalizes unethical behavior in sports. Examples are everywhere. Take disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong, who has admitted to doping.
"If you take me back to 1995, when it was completely and totally pervasive, I'd probably do it again. People don't like to hear that."
"Well, that's the honest answer."
"Yeah, that's the honest answer."
Or the more everyday transgressions, like flopping in basketball.
"Boy, Allen sold that. But then the post reaction, I mean, this is theatrical right here. Watch this. Oh yeah, I forgot. I gotta sell it more."
Or the 2018 Australian ball tampering scandal, where Australia's cricket team rubbed a ball with sandpaper. Maybe Lance Armstrong can learn about regret from cricketer Steve Smith, who broke down in tears over that.
"I'll do everything I can to make up for my mistake and the damage it's caused."
A a professor of sports ethics at UNC Chapel Hill, was tied to this massive cheating scandal in 2014, accused of directing fake courses where athletes could earn fake high grades. You can look at entire sports teams for examples of unfair behavior. Manchester City is accused of more than 100 financial violations.
There's so much money involved and so much status that people lose their minds and they lose their moral anchor and they go wherever the dollars take them.
Moser says maybe if society tries to teach ethics in youth sports, people will listen when they're adults. But advocating for that is like tilting at windmills, not a game you can win. He likes bowling, though. It's not scandal-free, but he says it's pretty boring to watch, which helps keep the money and the greed at bay.
He's done it!
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly Chin McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating report, Holly. That is a report after my own heart as a non-repentant Brit. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about making a better world.
We're joined now by Peter Singer. He's professor of bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton and author of Ethics in the Real World, 90 Essays on Things That Matter, as well as an updated edition of his classic book, Animal Liberation. Peter, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Thanks, Ray. It's good to be back after many, many years.
It's wonderful to have you back, Peter. Now, you've devoted your philosophical career to trying to make the world a better place, and indeed, in many cases, succeeding astonishingly well. But what first got you interested in ethics?
What first got me interested were the issues that were around when I was an undergraduate at the University of Melbourne in the 1960s. And I suppose the dominant issue then was the Vietnam War. Australia was an ally of the United States, and we reintroduced conscription, the draft for American, in order to provide troops to fight alongside Americans. And I was of draft age, so this was clearly of great personal interest to me. But I was opposed to the war, as many people were at the time as well. So that was the perhaps one big issue. And the other issue was the question of abortion, because we had a law prohibiting abortion that had not really been enforced. And then a Roman Catholic policeman was appointed to head the homicide squad, and he started bringing charges against doctors who had been terminating pregnancies for women in need. And that made that a very hot issue at the time, too.
Those do seem like really important real-world issues. But earlier, Josh and I were arguing about how useful philosophy is for bringing about real-world change. So what's the best thing that moral philosophy can do to make the world a better place?
Moral philosophy can clarify the issues that are being discussed and the arguments, and I think it can help to raise the level of discussion on these questions. So if you take, for example, the war in Vietnam, there's a long tradition of what makes a war a just war. And I think that it was helpful to have some of those discussions and some of those claims set out there. And it sort of pushes back against the kind of what might sometimes be called realism in politics, that nations will just fight in their when it's in their interests. And I think the fact that there is a different tradition helps people to think about that issue in an ethical framework. Was it a war in which one had to, there was a justified self-defense, you know, who was being attacked? I suppose there were a lot of factual issues that were in dispute in the case of the Vietnam War. But there were also questions about to what extent was it legitimate to attack civilians or to carry out actions that were likely to kill civilians. There was some of those doctrines, so-called doctrine of double effect was used, and had to ask whether that's a valid doctrine, that it was legitimate.
What's the doctrine of double effect, and how does it apply here?
The doctrine of double effect says that you may do something that would in itself be wrong, such as killing an innocent human being, if it's not your intention to kill, but you are carrying out a legitimate activity. So, for example, you talked about the trolley problem. So the doctrine of double effect can be used there as a way of saying that when you throw the switch, killing the one person, that's justifiable because it's not your intention to kill the one person. Your intention is to save the five, and that's sufficiently important to make it acceptable to for the death of the one person who you would have rather not killed if you could have. So you can apply that to, for example, bombing a military target where you know that you will be killing civilians around that target, but your intention is not to kill the civilians, and you try to minimize the deaths of those civilians. And that raises questions about, are you really trying to minimize the deaths of those civilians, or are you just doing whatever will be the simplest for you and have the least risk to, let's say, the people in the planes who are dropping bombs on the military target?
Yeah, it was clearly a big question for the Vietnam War, yeah.
It was a huge question, yes, that's right.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about making a better world with Peter Singer from Princeton University.
Has philosophy ever helped you solve a moral dilemma? Did thinking about animal rights inspire you to go vegan? Have you ever read something that changed how much you give to others?
When philosophy meets the real world, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Can philosophy inspire us to make a great leap forward, ethically speaking? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about making a better world with Peter Singer, author of Ethics in the Real World.
Got questions or suggestions about making a more ethical world? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and lose yourself in our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Peter, you were telling us about how philosophy can help us think through whether a war is justified. Do you have another example of a real-world issue that moral philosophy can help us get right or think through better?
Oh, I have several, but one that I'll start with is our treatment of animals. I think that philosophy has made a real difference in that area, because when I first got interested in this question, around 1970, the assumption was that the people who were interested in protecting animals, in not experimenting on them, for example, in the ways that were being done, or even didn't eat them, although that was extremely rare then, that they were animal lovers, that they had this feeling for animals that other people might not have. And so it was, you know, understandable for them to want to improve the conditions of animals, but why, you know, it just wasn't an issue for anyone else. It wasn't really as a moral issue, wasn't on very many people's radar at all then. But I think if you think about this philosophically, you can say, well, these are sentient beings. They can feel pain. They can suffer. Why should we think that their pain and suffering is less significant than similar kinds of pain and suffering that human beings might feel? And that then raises the question of, well, you know, they're not our species. Does that make a difference? And that gets you into that discussion. So I think that philosophy has really helped to put the treatment of non-human animals on the radar and, you know, made it one of the issues that gets frequently discussed in philosophy courses, but also discussed outside the university.
What's the best way to think about non-human animals from a philosophical perspective in relation to the question of what's morally permissible? I mean, is, you know, one strand of thought suggests that what makes a non-human animal particularly worthy of our moral attention is their ability to reason. For example, their capacity to plan. The great apes very much have this. Another strand suggests that it's more to do with sentiment, their capacity to feel. We shouldn't mistreat non-human animals because, after all, they feel suffering. They feel pain. They feel sorrow and anxiety the way that perhaps we do, or something like the way we do. Does it matter that they respond the way we do? Does it matter that they have or don't have reason? Does it matter that they have or don't have the capacity to feel? What are the crucial criteria here?
So to me, basically, it is a question of suffering. Jeremy Bentham said this almost 200 years ago. The question is not can they reason nor can they talk, but can they suffer? And he backed this up by saying, well, if it was whether they can reason or talk, then a dog or a horse is both more rational and more conversable than an infant of a day or a week or a month. So if we want to say that infants have rights or shouldn't be, we shouldn't ignore their interests, then we need to extend them to non-human animals as well. But I think that there is some relevance to some of the things you mentioned, for example, the ability to think ahead and think about your future, because that may change the interests you have. So my view is that we should give equal consideration to similar interests. And as I said before, that means that if a non-human animal feels a similar kind of pain to what I might feel, I shouldn't give more weight to my own pain than I give to that of the animal, or of course some other human who feels similar pain. But if we're talking about things like taking life, then maybe the fact that some beings have a different kind of interest in living, continuing to live, because of plans and projects that they've made and things that they've worked for perhaps for many years in order to try and achieve. And if they're killed, they can't achieve those things. And so maybe that has a greater significance for beings capable of thinking about their own future in that way than the loss of life does for another being who doesn't have that capacity.
So does that mean that it is okay to, say, kill and eat a cow as long as you do it humanely?
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean it's okay. That's a big debate. You could say, well, the cow could still have continued to live and enjoy life, and that's a harm to the cow that cow can't. But I certainly think that it means that it's different. It means that we don't have to equate the killing of the cow with the killing of somebody who has been planning for their future and wanting to go and live and wanting to go and living and wanting to, you know, whatever it might be, to see their children grow up or something of that kind, that we can assume perhaps the cow does not have those thoughts.
So you know who else doesn't have those thoughts is babies. So here's a kind of a thing that most people think is that it's like it's way worse to kill a baby human than to kill a cow, but they seem kind of similar in terms of their ability to look forward to the future. Like neither of them has a conception of the future yet. Does that mean that we've just kind of misjudged sort of the relative values of babies versus cows?
Well, I do think that it's relevant to how tragic the death of a baby is, that the baby does not have those thoughts of the future. And I think a lot of why the deaths of very young infants are tragic, it has to do with the hopes and wishes of the parents and others who love and care for that child. Because I do think that in some respect, yes, as you say, the mental life of the infant, or as Bentham said too, is not more rational than that of the cow, maybe probably less if we're talking about the very young infant. So, yeah, I think you have to look externally, if you like, outside that particular child to see why it's tragic that that child should die.
Peter, we've got a question from a listener. It's Jenny in San Francisco. Jenny writes this: during COVID, my partner and I strongly disagreed about whether the government should be able to force people to get vaccinated. I said that no one was ever held down and forcibly vaccinated, but there were restrictions imposed for those who chose not to get vaccinated. My partner thought the restrictions in some cases amounted to state coercion. Can philosophy help with our disagreement?
Well, philosophy can help by asking what counts as coercion. And I suppose asking whether state coercion is always wrong, because clearly state coercion is not always wrong. Your partner needs to explain more about that, because we think that, you know, the state is entitled to coerce you to take taxes so that it can provide the various essential services that states provide. In this case, I'm inclined to agree with you that the restrictions were not really coercion. Let's say that you could not go to public events without, you know, showing a vaccination certificate. You couldn't go to the theater or to a sports event, or maybe even you couldn't use public transport, or certainly you couldn't fly. But, you know, you can survive without those things. They're not strictly essential. The public transport one, if it really applies to everything, trains and buses, might be a great hardship. But after all, if you are not vaccinated and you do use public transport, you are likely to be increasing the risk that your fellow passengers will get COVID. So if that is in fact a correct statement of the facts, then it's not for your own good that the state is coercing you to be vaccinated. It's so that you don't harm others.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about making a better world with Peter Singer from Princeton University. Peter, we've been talking a bit about places where philosophy can provide insight that's useful for people. Do you think that there are any moral questions on which philosophy has been particularly unhelpful?
Questions on which philosophy is less helpful are questions which depend greatly on the facts, and there are different views of the facts, and it's hard for people to sort it out. And sometimes questions about whether a war is a just war will depend very much on disputed facts about what's happening. I don't think that's the case in the case of Russia's invasion of Ukraine today, but it was more disputed in the case of the Vietnam War as to what the origins of the conflict were and whether it was a civil war or whether it was an invasion of one country by another.
And that seems like, so it seems like we need to have facts, but once we have the facts, then there are three possible positions, right? One position is the one that you have and that, frankly, I agree with, which is that moral philosophy at that point often can help us. But then there are folks who say, no, it's neither here nor there. All that philosophy is doing at that point is rationalizing the beliefs we came in with. We just had some intuitions. They aren't particularly rational. Maybe they're prejudices. And then we use all this machinery of philosophy to justify them. And then there's an even worse thought, which is moral philosophy, all it does is confuse us, right? Moral dumbfounding. It just we just get put in front of these thought experiments that bamboozle us and cause us to give up and perhaps become less morally good, or maybe we have moral self-licensing. We feel like, well, I just did all my morality in the classroom when I learned all that moral philosophy, and now I've done all that. I gave it the office. Now I can go and break a lamppost. So what's your best justification for saying, no, it's not bad for you morally. It's not even neutral. It's actually morally good that you read moral philosophy or listen to moral philosophers.
Well, I think the clear proof of that is a carefully controlled experiment that Eric Schwitzgebel, Brad Coakley, and I did a couple of years ago, which has been published in peer-reviewed journals.
I love this experiment.
Thank you. In which we, or Eric, I should say, had a large class at UC Riverside and randomized so that half the class took part in a discussion about the ethics of eating meat, and the other half took part in a different discussion about giving to charity. But that was just a control group. We had no way of assessing whether that increased people's giving to charity. But we did have a way of assessing whether the class on the ethics of eating meat changed what they ate. And that was because at UC Riverside, students used their student ID card to pay for meals at the student cafeteria. And the cafeteria agreed to cooperate with us in giving us feedback so that we could check the ID numbers with the students who had been in the two groups. And somewhat to Eric's surprise, because he was a little bit on the skeptical side about the value of moral philosophy, we actually got a statistically significant drop in meat consumption in those who had been in the class discussing meat ethics, and no change at all in the others who had been in the control group. So I think, you know, that has really established that a class in moral philosophy can change what people eat. And that's a pretty significant change in the real world.
That's a cool result. I do wonder about how it generalizes to cases where there's more disagreement. Like, what happens if you present moral philosophy classes on an issue that moral philosophers don't agree with? Like, I'm worried that meat is an easy issue. Maybe it's not an
well,
easy
I'm glad
issue.
You think it's. I'm really glad you think meat is an easy issue, because you know, you don't have to go back very far for people to think it wasn't an issue at all. That it was just obvious that, you know, animals were here for us to use, and we were so superior to them that it didn't really matter very much what we did to them. So I'm not sure what other issues you would say are not easy issues. What about giving something significant to people in extreme poverty, which is another issue that I've worked on? You know, you may say, well, that's an easy issue. We all agree we should give. But in fact, people generally don't give, or they give, you know, trivial amounts, even though they could easily afford to give substantial amounts. So that's another area where moral philosophy has certainly changed things. And, you know, I don't have a nice study like the one I mentioned with meat, but there is some research showing that some arguments, you know, a variety of arguments can influence people, including both philosophical arguments and emotional arguments influence people in that direction. But the philosophical arguments do have some influence.
Right. So I guess the issue that I had in mind was actually abortion, where you have people sort of arguing on different sides about what is right or what is right for society to do. And it seems like in the meat and charity cases, you have sort of more people agreeing about what the right thing is in theory, but being kind of weak-willed about doing it in practice. And maybe the meat issue has kind of changed over the decades that you've been doing philosophy. So I might just be taking the wrong moral snapshot.
Right. So on the abortion issue, I think religion clearly plays a big role. So one of the facts that you would need to establish is there a God? And or if there is a God, does God think that it's bad for us to terminate pregnancies? Because I think if you took religion out of the abortion debate, you would get overwhelming support for abortion. And I think that's actually the right conclusion to come to philosophically as well. So it's difficult for philosophy to actually affect that issue without getting at the religious basis of many people's beliefs.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about making a better world with Peter Singer from Princeton University, author of Ethics in the Real World.
Will future generations be horrified by our moral failings? How can we rise above the prejudices of our era? Would it help to require an ethics class or two?
Saving the world one argument at a time. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. What do we need to throw away for things to get better? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Peter Singer from Princeton University, and we're thinking about making a better world.
So Peter, with the enormous powers vested in us by KLW Radio, we're going to make you a global philosopher king for the day. What's the first big thing you're going to do to bring about a better world?
I think I'm going to decree that we should stop eating animals and commercially raising animals for their meat, milk, and eggs. I think that will not only enormously reduce animal suffering on a scale that is so vast it's difficult to comprehend, but it will also dramatically reduce greenhouse gases, which is something that we very urgently need to do. It will reduce in local pollution, because factory farms in particular are extremely polluting of water and air in their local area. And it will reduce public health risks, both from the overuse of antibiotics and other antimicrobials, which creates resistance among bacteria. And it will also reduce the risk of another pandemic emerging from factory farms, as the swine flu pandemic did in the early 2000s.
I mean, I'm totally on board with that. But since we have you as Philosopher King, maybe we can ask you to issue more excellent decrees. One of the things I'm wondering about is long-termism, right? So your name is associated with effective altruism. And one of the offshoots of effective altruism is the idea of paying more attention than before to the long-term prospects of the human species, trying to get out ahead of dangers to our entire kind. How much do you think, you know, if you're you as Philosopher King, how much of your decree would be devoted to what you see as potential threats, whether it be AI or climate change or anything else that's potentially on the horizon at a species level?
I certainly would pay attention to those threats. They're rather different. Climate change, as I already mentioned, is something that we need to deal with now. It's already changing the climate in really adverse ways. I'm speaking to you from Australia, where, of course, we are greatly at risk of bushfires. We've had terrible fires previously. And in the United States now, of course, the Canadian forests are burning in ways that they haven't previously. So that's not a long-term issue. I mean, it's also a long-term issue because it is going to get worse for centuries. But it's a present issue as well. So I think that's something that I would definitely make decrees about. I already mentioned eliminating meat production as a contributing factor, but there's a lot more that we need to do to cut out fossil fuels as well. When you talk about things like AI and that being a danger of extinction, which is something a lot of people have been talking about just recently, the one question is, can we actually do something about this? Because, you know, problems have to be tractable. It's one of the AI mantra is that you should think about problems that are large scale, that are neglected, and also that are tractable. And a lot of people have been saying, well, yes, you know, we should have a moratorium on AI, but nobody is suggesting how we're actually going to have a moratorium on developing AI, given that it's being developed in different countries, that the defense departments of both the United States and China, I'm sure, are looking at this. And how are you going to get a treaty that we will not try to develop AI? It's going to be much harder to monitor, obviously, than a nuclear disarmament treaty. So you need to think how we're actually going to be able to contribute to this issue. I think it's great that people are working on this and are thinking about it, and that's fine. But to me, it's not the issue that ought to get the lion's share of the resources that are going into effective altruism. I think there are more present issues, including global poverty, that should get more of those resources.
So if we're flagging technologies that could pose a threat to human beings and that are hard to stamp out, I always also wonder about sort of military technologies. So you have countries building and stockpiling weapons, which seems bad from a climate perspective. Using these weapons kind of accelerates climate change, and also bad from a poverty perspective. Those resources could be going to sort of food and housing for people. Do you have any views on militarization and what we might do about it?
I don't know what we can do about it, because again, it's an issue in which countries compete, and there isn't enough trust to say, well, we'll just all agree not to build more weapons. And you know, you look exactly at what's happening in Europe now. Europe had cut down its commitments to defense, and then Russia invades Ukraine, and Europe, I think very reasonably, sees this as a threat. Certainly the countries that were formerly under the domination of the Soviet Union, like Poland and the Baltic states, certainly see this as a threat. So Europe now starts increasing its expenditure on the military. And I don't blame them for doing that, honestly. I mean, I do think that looking at what Putin is doing brings back memories of the 1930s and Hitler's incremental expansions of German territory leading up to the Second World War. And you know, a lot of people say, well, it would have been better if Hitler had been stopped earlier. So I don't think we want to allow Putin to take over Ukraine and then have a larger and more powerful country, which could then start to attack other neighbors that in some sense used to be part of the Soviet sphere. So I don't see a way of actually stopping that in the world at present. But it's up to us what we eat. And also, of course, we can be politically active on things like the treatment of animals and factory farming. The same is true for global poverty. It's up to us how much of our income or wealth we donate to effective charities that are helping people in extreme poverty. And we can also let our political representatives know that we think it's shameful that the government is giving so little to foreign aid. Those are clearly tractable issues where we can have an impact. And I haven't really focused a lot on demilitarization for just the reasons I gave.
One of the things I love about your book is, I mean, it's you know, uniformly brilliant, but also extremely wide-ranging. And you have all kinds of recommendations, all kinds of areas. For example, recommending the Australian system for voting, where people are essentially required to vote. And you make this very nice suggestion. Australians want to be coerced into voting. So it's not paternalistic. It's not really coercive. It's ultimately what people want. You talk about fake news. You criticize Judge Brandeis for saying the response, you know, our proper response to misinformation is more speech. All these areas. But the one I want to come back to before we run out of time, in spite of the fact that it's lower stakes, is cheating in sports. Because I love your chapter about this. You know, I also think of that. You cite Manuel Neuer, the German goalkeeper, who essentially pretended the ball didn't go in. I think of positive cases, Robbie Fowler saying, no, it wasn't a penalty. He didn't trip me. But what bothers me is that in this context is that commentators seem to be changing. They seem to be normalizing cheating. You know, when I was a kid, it used to be that was a cynical foul. This shouldn't be part of the game. And nowadays, these commentators are saying, oh, that was great. That he took one for the team. That was a good foul to give. You know, what's happening? Why are these norms being eroded, right? So you've got rules and you've got norms. Yeah, of course, you can trip somebody up. And you could say, well, he tripped the person up. He got the yellow card. That's all within the rules. What's going on? Is this just a kind of a microcosm of a general erosion of adherence to norms in our societies?
Well, in the case of sport, it may also be that the stakes get higher, that it becomes more important to win. The idea of sport as a kind of amateur, gentlemanly, or I shouldn't really say gentlemanly, should I? Obviously, it includes women. But that was a bit of the atmosphere, that it wasn't something that was entirely serious. I'm old enough to remember when the big tennis tournaments, Wimbledon and the US Open, were only open to amateurs. You couldn't be a professional player. So I think that's the fact that it is professional, that there's huge amounts of money at stake, sponsorships as well, and that so much effort goes into winning, I think has probably helped to decay that sort of code of you should not cheat, you should act honorably.
Yeah, and I like your prescription, which is don't let them get away with it. The even though the stakes appear to be low because it's just a game. On the other hand, as you say, these matches are watched by millions or tens of millions of people. These folks should be a good example. Thinking of which, I did want to ask you about effective altruism. This is a movement that you have essentially brought into being. Large numbers of folks, including many of my friends, who are following your recommendation to do the most good you can by using reason, by looking for evidence, giving to the most effective charities, giving as much as you can. But it's kind of hit a little bit of a bump in the road recently with the scandal around Sam Bankman-Fried, who's in the effective altruist movement, but has been charged with a number of financial crimes. And so, as I understand it, one of the questions that's been raised is, does this shed any kind of troubling light on the movement as a whole? Because this is a consequentialist movement, right? The idea is it's okay to take a job in the financial world, which we might or might not love in itself, because you can do the most good with the money you make. But then when you see a case like this where you think, well, this guy kind of cut corners in order to achieve that, is it okay to cut corners? I mean, what does a good consequentialist say about that? If you're going to make billions to give to charity, is it okay? That seems kind of troubling.
Well, I think a consequentialist will say it's great to make billions and give them to charity if, firstly, you're not doing more harm by making the billions than the amount of the good that the charities can do. But if, in fact, you are violating some basic rules, which consequentialists too will do well to observe, because in general, the consequences of observing those rules will be better than the consequences of breaking them, then you've made a very serious mistake. And I think that's, well, if we accept the allegations made against Sam Bankman-Fried, then he did make an extremely serious mistake. He really was, I suppose, gambling with other people's money. And when the gamble didn't pay off, the money wasn't there. And that was a loss of trust in what he was doing. And because he was perhaps the most prominent proponent of earning to give, as it's called, this practice of trying to earn a lot of money in order to give it effectively to do good in the world, he certainly tarnished that idea, which I think is still basically a sound idea. Maybe we're now more aware of the temptations that people may be under when they're doing that, but I don't think it really undermines the ethics of effective altruism as a whole. I think it is a case of showing, well, there are people who will make mistakes in any large institution and make very serious mistakes.
Pisa, thank you so much for joining us today. I feel like a better person already.
That's great. Good. Keep doing it. And I hope all the people who listen will, because that's another thing that we haven't talked about, actually, that doing good and living in accordance with your values does make people feel better and enjoy their life more. Go for it.
Thanks a billion. Our guest has been Pisa Singer, Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton, and author of Ethics in the Real World, as well as an updated edition of his classic book, Animal Liberation. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
There's so much to get to in this conversation. I'm regretting that we didn't get to talk at all about disability rights. There's been some really interesting criticism of and exchanges with Peter Singer on that. I particularly recommend the essay Unspeakable Conversations by Harriet McBride Johnson, which is in this wonderful anthology Disability Visibility, edited by Alice Wong. And so I recommend the whole anthology.
Fantastic.
And I also recommend Animal Liberation.
Yeah, me too. And again, Ethics in the Real World, it's a treat to read, I'm telling you. We're going to put links to that and to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, a man who speeds his way to a better world, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it's not easy building a better world. Much of the world is in flames, making it hard to gather pieces from which to build. It's like working with melted Legos, or Legos so encumbered with proprietary restrictions you have to wade through lawyers just to make a tiny house. You ever try to make an organic farm place set from a Spider-Man versus Dr. Octopus mech battle building set? Well, then, you know what I'm talking about. Also, doing the right thing often means doing the wrong thing. Take the ongoing switchover from gas to electric in our moving vehicles. Despite enthusiasm from patchouli-reeking tree huggers, big oil lumbers on as red states like Texas make it illegal to use state funds to promote or invest in alternative energy sources. And electric means batteries, which means copper, cadmium. Bad enough getting support for wind and solar. Who wants to greenlight copper mines? Remember the Anaconda pit mine out of Butte, Montana? Finally abandoned, it filled up the groundwater and was a frequent cause of death for migrating birds who would land there for a refreshing drink and then fall dead from the sky moments later. After many years of toxic cleanup, it has eventually become something of a tourist attraction. Before you know it, there will be scuba diving forays to see what three-headed trout have evolved in those deeps. Who knows? Mines are a kettle of fish, and water power means dams. Hoover Dam's reservoir is running low, as is the Colorado River. Arizona itself is in the middle of a mega drought, in the middle of always being a desert, which is probably why it became pals with Saudis way back in the early 20th century. Saudis went nuts for Arizona's desert farming techniques, which are said to be amazing, but might be better employed, I would think, in areas more conducive to farming, such as a place with topsoil and some kind of measurable annual rainfall. They do have sunlight, which led to alfalfa farms in Arizona, a very water-intensive crop first used for silage for Saudi racehorses. Alfalfa in Arizona uses the aquifer, where farms and houses surrounding alfalfa farms often have to bring in their own water on trucks. So there is the free market in action. On the plus side, innovative desert farming. On the minus, water only belongs to who has it. In the West, water is kind of like Bitcoin, a commodity, but also currency. Except now, because of advanced desert farming to feed Saudi quadrupeds, Arizona is running out of groundwater. One of the county supervisors in Arizona referred to the aquifer as forever water. Of course, forever water doesn't last forever. If you drink it all, it's gone. Water is fraught, especially in California. Farmers want it, business wants it, agribusiness wants so much of it, they think the rest of us are traitors for being thirsty. Not to mention those who want salmon to spawn, bleeding heart fish breeders, go suck on a sponge with Greta Thunberg. Golf courses, though, golf courses and lawns will always get their portion. In red state world, water's mine, not a privilege, a right. And you only want it because you're too woke. And the manufactured outrages all just bleed together. I read an article in Slate about breastfeeding in the trans community, which has the right to a tizzy. See, I didn't know this, but anybody can produce milk. But, Slate says, quote, when it comes to producing enough milk to be a food source for a child, something called the Newman-Goldfarb protocols for induced lactation come into play, unquote. So, with hormones and patience, anybody can be a wet nurse. I don't know why conservatives get so upset about this. I mean, if trans women are lactating, who cares? Pay attention. Cis men can lactate. It won't be long before they take over from women, which means no more free lunch babies. Monetized. It's like your own personal aquifer, only milk. Eventually, we could end world hunger with an army of male wet nurses, fully armed, breasts proud, marching from village to village, expressing milk in bottles and special huts for a reasonable fee, then moving on to a future world with a little more water certainty. Hopefully. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
We should be educating ourselves to be citizens of the world and not of some guarded suburban enclave.
What we want is to leave the planet better than we found it.
Okay, well, good luck with that.